Hey, podcast listeners, it's Michael Shelley here. Last week's Jonathan Richman interview was amazing in many respects. One is that it caused more comments on the playlist for the program and more emails than any, and more Facebook action than anything I've ever done, which is weird. A lot of different opinion about Jonathan and about the interview and about me. It was a learning experience. Anyways, I don't know. I guess my mind is still slightly reeling from that experience. And then Thanksgiving, and now here we are in the Christmas season. I just came from Target, where I hate that place. It's the worst. Where pajamas are not apparel. They had a sign, all apparel, 40% off, but pajamas, apparently not apparel. Don't ask me. I've got two interviews today. One is with Peter Guralnick. Sometimes journalists are not the best people to interview, and I've interviewed a lot of people that have written books because they're not show-offs. I don't know. Sometimes they're not natural hams. But Peter Guralnick, such an important music writer, and his books are coming out as e-books, as you'll hear. So I interview him, and then German writer Michael Spöcke, which is how he told me to say his name, who wrote this book about Big Mama Thornton. It's just a very straightforward book about her life, nothing more, nothing less. But I thought it was interesting, and he's a nice guy, and so we're going to hear him after we hear Peter Guralnick. So some good stuff coming up. Check WFMU.org/Michael for the full list. And hope your holiday season is getting off to a good start. Talk to you soon. You see, I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more. You better believe it. Peter Guralnick, welcome to WFMU. It's a really a pleasure to have you here because, you know, for years and years, since I got interested in music, I've been reading your books, and they are among, you know, the most valued, the most respected works of their kind, really, in American music. And a lot of them are coming out as e-books in the next couple of months. And I guess that's sort of what we're here to talk about. How did you get started writing? What you know, when was it, and what happened?
It was an accident of passion. It was a crime of passion. But I just, when I was 15 or 16, I just kind of fell into the blues. A friend of mine and I discovered his brother had gone to the Newport Folk Festival, came back with some records, and we just, all kinds of folk music, but we just flipped over the blues records. And that just set me off on a course. And so, you know, this friend, Bob Smith, and I were just fanatic about it. And, you know, one discovery led to another, and they were discoveries. I mean, it was just such a thrill and such a, you know, from the time of seeing the first blues singer that I ever saw, I think when I was 16 or 17, I saw Lightnin' Hopkins, and it just, oh, my God, it actually exists in live reality and living, you know, just. And, but, so anybody who knew me, you know, knew about this passion for the music. There was no intention to write about it. I mean, I wanted to be a writer from the time I was a little kid. I published a collection of stories when I was 20 and another one when I was 21, and I was writing novels. But when the underground press started up, and in Boston, it was on several levels. Crawdaddy started up. I knew the kid who started it. The Phoenix started up in Boston, I think around 67. And so people came to me and said, how would you like to write about music? And I said, you mean, how would I like to write about the music that I love? And that's what I did. I mean, it was just an opportunity to tell people about how great this music was, about trying to convey some of that passion with no idea. This was just a complete avocation. It had nothing to do. I never thought it would lead to anything, but it was trying to tell people how great Howlin' Wolf was, how great James Brown was, and the stories I wrote and the early interviews I did. This was way before interviews. I mean, the stories I initially wrote were describing what it was like to see James Brown, what it was like to see Muddy Waters or Howlin' Wolf, sort of trying to entice readers to kind of go out and see them that following week or following weekend. So that's how I started, and then I quickly discovered how satisfying it was to be able to convey some of this, and I discovered the profile as my way of communicating that, because, you know, without any background, without any academic background in ethnomusicology, which I don't even know if it existed then, I mean as a name, or without any musical knowledge, what I tried to do, what I very quickly discovered, was that the way that I had to speak about the music was having the people who made the music talk about it and try to convey what was at the source of their inspiration and their creativity.
So this is, of course, before the internet. So you had to go track these people down and take a tape recorder and actually speak to them. And I assume you've saved all those tapes over the years?
Yeah. No. I have all the interviews. I didn't use tape for everybody. It was hard to say at the beginning exactly what led to my taping some interviews and not others. I never taped Charlie Rich in all the times I spoke to him because it never seemed appropriate. I didn't tape Skip James, who was the first interview I ever did, because I was afraid to bring a tape recorder into the room or into the house. I was too self-conscious. But after a while, I started taping everything. And yeah, I do have all the tapes, and they've all been digitized too.
I was listening because Sweet Soul Music is just coming out with this enhanced ebook, and there's some very interesting and very candid interviews, you know, with clearly the subjects are very relaxed. They're, you know, cursing and just saying everything. And those are, you know, sort of fascinating to listen to. I really enjoy those. There's sort of a, like in America, there's a moment where, you know, like I think when the Beatles first came to America, the people that wrote about them and reviewed them were simply the culture writers of the newspaper. You know, whoever wrote about the ballet maybe might be sent to record to go talk to the Beatles. And then there sort of became a shift with this, what you talked about, the underground press and things like Rolling Stone and guys like Cameron Crowe, who would be expected to go do drugs, you know, with the band and sort of get embedded with the band. And
right.
I've always felt you sort of missed something, because by sending the guy who is not assumed to be cool, he has to go sort of find out about something he doesn't know about, you know, whereas Cameron Crowe, there's such an assumed coolness that there's less innate curiosity. So where on the scale do you fit in those two models?
Well, I don't know. I don't think either one really fit what I was doing, because what I was writing about was completely off the beaten path. There was nobody who was, I talk about the beaten path, there was nobody who was beating a path to Muddy Waters' door or to Solomon Burke's, for example. And I was really coming to it. I've never written about anyone or anything that I wasn't totally enthusiastic about. I mean, that was, you know, so it wasn't a question of hiding my feelings in any way. It was a question really of I guess, controlling my feelings more than anything else. But what I tried to do was I tried to know as much as I could going in. Sometimes it wasn't that much that you could know, because in the absence of the internet, very little had been written about many of the people. Somebody like Dan Penn, for example, when I interviewed him with Spooner Oldham and Donnie Fritz, I think the three of them together, I there may have been a very little bit written in some English soul magazines, but there was very little factual knowledge available. So I went in with as much knowledge as I could, as much context. But essentially, whoever I was interviewing, I tried to, to be myself.
The first book was Feel Like Going Home, and it's mostly about the blues, 1971. So mm-hmm. That's a perfect time for sort of the blues to be in this netherland. You know, it's because they were just, because there was so much new stuff happening, and because, you know, so many younger people had kind of reinvented the blues and, you know, the Stones and people like that.
Well, it's like you say, when you speak of a perfect time, I mean, in the audio, you know, the excerpt from the interview that I did with Muddy, the original interview that's in the enhanced edition, in the enhanced ebook edition of Feel Like Going Home, at the end I say to Muddy, well, do you have any regrets? And I don't remember if there's a pause, but he says, yeah, I do. I wish I had been discovered when I was younger, earlier. I wish I had been discovered when I was younger and I could put out more. And, you know, I felt like, okay, that's real. You know, but the big thing, and to go back to your original question, the big thing for me was that none of the interviews that I've ever done has been like a, whatever the audio equivalent of a photo op is. I mean, they've never been pegged to publicity moments. They've never, it's not as if they're done within a flurry of publicity interviews to to publicize a new book, a new album, a new movie, a new, you know, which is so much the mode of sort of contemporary communication. When I went to see Muddy Waters, he was laid up from an automobile accident. It was the longest time he'd ever spent off the road, but there was nothing to plug. And when I, you know, with Solomon, I've got the popcorn story. I think the unexpurgated version of the popcorn story, 13 minutes, very hard to hear, but I was just going around with Solomon, and we were backstage at a gospel program and started talking about it, and he just took off. And even though it's hard to hear, to me it was just, you know, it was such a wonderful recounting of that story that it was worth putting in.
And that story is that he sold popcorn in between shows, right? Is that right?
Well, essentially, in his story, and it becomes a parable like so many stories that Solomon tells, and there's a truth in it which is beyond the purely entertaining truth, which is enormously entertaining. But the basic story is that the Apollo, the Schiffmans, needed him because Little Willie John had dropped out as a headliner, and the second headliner dropped out because she was pregnant, and they needed him at the last minute, and he came up, and he said, as long as you give me the concessions. And they said, sure, sure, you can have the concessions, which in their mind meant selling photographs and, you know, the kinds of things that people, you know, sell to merch, you know, that people sell today. But Solomon says he had in his contract that he got all the concessions. And the reason that he needed to do that was because he had just started a chain of drugstores, and he had bought thousands of boxes, you know, of popcorn. I forget why they were, and candy, too, but the popcorn was a big thing. And so he showed up with his popcorn at the Apollo, and the regular concessionaire said, oh, you know, you can't sell that here. And he says, read the contract. And that's it takes off from there.
I had him on the show a couple times. I think he said he used to make sandwiches to sell on the bus, you know. Well, everyone...
Oh, he did. Yeah, he sold bottled water. He sold sandwiches. He had a complete stock of food, because the point is, as soon as you cross the Mason-Dixon line, nobody who was new to the tour would understood it. But as soon as you crossed the Mason-Dixon line, because of segregation, there was no way to go to get food. So Solomon had the means to cook all the food. he had a stocked bar, even though he himself didn't drink. He was just an amazing person, Solomon.
Do you agree that in some ways the history of America, certainly the history of civil rights, you know, can be read in just the stories of these musicians and these record labels?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think that... I mean, not exclusively, but all of my work. I mean, it's like the Sam Cooke is, and I guess Sweet Soul Music are perhaps most explicit about race in America. But they're all of the books are to one extent or another about race, about the civil rights movement, about the growing awareness of racial injustice and the attempts to right it, but they're written from the point of view. I mean, Sam Phillips set out to create a revolution. Now, he set out to do it musically, to be sure, but he also set out to do it. I mean, he had such an awareness of racial disparity, of the injustice that existed from the time he was a young kid. And to his mind, rock and roll, the music, I mean, long before it was called, that was a way to write, example.
In preparing these books for the new e-book enhanced re-releases, was there things you'd forgotten about that you were sort of tickled to rediscover?
To a degree. I mean, that was what was fun about going through the interviews. I mean, I had a sense of what interviews I wanted to include. But, for example, Joe Tex was one of... I spent several days with him in Navasota, Texas, where he lived, and, you know, stayed with him at the house, and he was just such a wonderful guy. And I thought, man, that would be a great interview to include. And it was, in a way, but it wasn't, I mean, maybe I was too over the top, but it wasn't focused enough. I couldn't, you know, find it. So I included instead, as a kind of bonus chapter, a profile of Joe Tex at the end of Sweet Soul Music. But I think in going through, you know, it's like I mentioned the Merle Haggard interview or the Ray Charles interview in Sweet Soul Music. And it was just kind of, or the Big Joe Turner interview with Lloyd Glenn in Lost Highway. And I hadn't listened to them in a million years. And so even though they were extrapolated in the books, it was just to hear their voices and to have this kind of engagement, their engagement, and to have more than just what was in the book. Sometimes I'd get lost in that, and I said, wait a minute, you got to pick out an excerpt that's going to work. So that it was that kind of rediscovery that was really cool. It was just fun. It was really a lot of fun.
So of the folks that you interviewed, is there one that sticks out particularly as somebody who became your friend or somebody who you were surprised, was so warm to you? Is there someone that you became fond of?
Well, I became close to an awful lot of the people that I wrote about and pretty much stopped writing about them at that point. I mean, I became very close to Sleepy LaBeef, to Jack Clement, to Solomon Burke, to a whole variety of people. I mean, Solomon was just the most fun in the world. I mean, I was with Solomon in so many different places, just all over the world. I mean, if you call Italy the world, then that covers all over the world. But he was so funny and he was so full of life. But I mean, all of these people have been they've informed my life. I mean, I to begin with, I'm so grateful for the way, and J.W. Alexander, I mean, he was just the greatest guy in the world, just Doc Pomus. I mean, it was just such a privilege to be able to be welcomed into their world. And so somebody like Muddy, whom I knew somewhat over the years, I would have loved to have been buddies with Muddy, but I wouldn't claim it. But the point is, it was a thrill just to be in his world and to have an opportunity to spend time there and to meet people who were involved with him, or the same with Merle Haggard. But then Charlie Rich. I mean, I can't believe I didn't mention Charlie Rich. I mean, who was just as good a friend as I've ever had, but who was a deeply melancholic friend. So, I mean, and was, almost the opposite of Solomon. So I wrote about these people because I admired their work so much. And that admiration was never in any way compromised or lessened. And, they didn't have to be perfect people any more than I would expect, any more than I would ever be a perfect person. I mean, you're not living your life to be a role model. In so many instances, the relationships that I had with him subsequent to that, I mean, it's like with Solomon, I wrote about him in Sweet Soul Music, and I may have written about him liner notes or a couple, one or two times afterwards. But once that was over, I mean, I couldn't write about him anymore because, we were such good friends that I wouldn't want to hurt his feelings by writing something that I wouldn't want to be dishonest with the reader by writing something that wasn't totally straightforward. So it's a funny conundrum, but it continued to offer me the opportunity just to be part of that world and it was just part of what I guess Dick Curlis, the country singer, called learning and growing experiences. I mean, it's been the greatest privilege of my life, the greatest opportunity of my life.
We're talking to Peter Guralnick, and petergoralnick.com is the website, and all of his books are coming out in new e-book, enhanced e-book editions. Is there a song that we can close this out with that sums it all up?
There's no song that sums it all up, but I mean, the song that is of particular significance for me, or just import, is the demo version of Charlie Rich's "Feel Like Going Home," just solo piano, and he had written it. I mean, I went to see him at Max's Kansas City in New York. I just went down. I hadn't seen him in a while, and this was just as "Behind Closed Doors," which was his breakthrough hit, was totally unexpectedly breaking. He was out on this kind of tour to promote his new album, and nobody expected it to do anything, and he's playing these little clubs, and all of a sudden "Behind Closed Doors" just broke wide open, country and pop. But at the club, he says, "I've got a surprise for you," And it turned out to be a huge surprise to the band, too, because he played this song, which they had clearly never heard before. And it was Feel Like Going Home. And he said, you know, I wrote this. This is the end I told Elvis moment. Maybe you can't include this because it's self-aggrandizing. But he said to me, he said, you know, I wrote this song from the feeling that I got from the book Feel Like Going Home. I mean, it wasn't because you wrote about me, but it was the feeling that I took from Muddy Waters, from all these people that I wrote, that I took from the book overall. And he played it, and then he did a demo of it, and he sent me the demo. And the only way that demo survived was because somebody must have it somewhere else, but it's never turned up anywhere else, and I just have this little 7-inch reel. And it's come out since then in a number of different ways. Greg Geller put it out on an album called CBS Rockabillies. But it's so bleak and so touching and so moving. The song itself, forget the story, you can cut out the whole anecdote, but the song itself, and it was so thrilling for me that night in Max's Kansas City, and it remains that thrilling to me.
Yeah, I had no idea. A song inspired by the book. That's I didn't know that. Good luck with the books. And good luck with Sam Phillips is coming up. I mean, he certainly is a character, to say the least.
Oh, he was just such an. I mean, Sam Phillips was another person with whom I became very close over a period of many years, and he was such a genius. But I mean, the first meeting I had with him in '79 was just about as. I've just never met anyone quite like that. His articulation of his philosophy in what was a very economical, probably 2-hour interview. Most interviews with him went on for 4 hours, 6 hours, or, you know, until the cows came home. But this was, because of the circumstances, was relatively brief. But it was just absolutely just earth-shattering for me to meet him at that time. So, yeah, that was, again, a book that I've wanted to write ever since then. I was since 1979, and now I have.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, and like I say, good luck with the new releases.
Well, thanks. Thanks very much. I've really enjoyed it.
Lord, I feel like going home. I tried and I failed, and I'm tired and weary. And everything I done was wrong. And I feel like going home. Lord, I tried to see it through, but it was too. For me, and now I'm coming home to you. I feel like going. Not a friend around to help me. From all the places I have been,
Now I feel like going home. Lord, I feel like going home. I tried and I failed. And I'm tired and weary. Everything I've done was wrong. And I feel like going. And that's it.
Well, Michael Sperker, welcome to WFMU. You are the author of this new book called Big Mama Thornton, The Life and Music. Interesting lady. I didn't really know much about her. I sort of knew some of her music. And the two main things that stuck with me the most was, number one, how everybody you talked about how great a singer she was, how great her voice was, even right up until the end. And the second thing that was made a big impact on me was how much alcohol she drank so consistently. It seemed like she always had some kind of booze with her at all times.
Well, yeah. Of course, she had this incredible, great voice. And even in her last years, she toured until she died, just a few days until she died, she was on tour. And still, during that time, she had this great voice still. And she was a big drinker, of course. I mean, she did drink her whiskey and her gin and her grand old dad. She was an alcoholic, and she didn't make a big deal of it and didn't try to hide it. It was just her thing, and she said, well, I don't need any trucks or any needles or stuff. I just have my grand old dad, and that's it.
Yeah, there's a funny moment in the book where she was sort of berating people in the audience for smoking pot, and she said, we're all alcoholics up here. We don't smoke pot.
Right. She hated pot. Yeah. That was a funny thing for me, too. In her case, it was very clear she loved her drinks, but no other trucks. And yeah, she could be getting very mad if she smelled pot in her audience. Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you know all this stuff? How many people did you talk to write a book about her?
Oh, I think about 80 people, 90 people. Might be almost 100 people over the years. The thing was, when I first started to research about her, I found a lot of, sensational things and stories that were made up or that sounded funny or whatever, but I didn't find so much about the real person. And so I was looking for really the people who did really know her. So I was trying to be able to write about the person, really, and I hope I did a good job. So.
She's born in 1926 in a small town in Alabama, and she starts singing, and she starts singing professionally at a very young age.
Yeah, well, she started to make music when she was a child. The first thing that she started was singing in a choir in a church. Her father was a minister, and later on she learned to play the harmonica from the old harmonicas that her older brother played. And when he put his old harmonicas in the garbage, she took them away, and then she practiced. And as we all know, she practiced very well since she was a great harmonica player too. When her mother got very sick and later on died, she needed to find a job and she found one in a little club, and job was there to clean the club. But then she took her chance to also sing there. Well, the story goes on when the House Harlem Review came to her hometown. The Grandma Thornton, or Willie Mae Thornton, as she was called during that time, came to this audition, and of course she won, and then she started to go with the House Harlem Review when she was 14 years old, and from that time on, she didn't stop to make music.
One of the interesting things about the book is it sort of tells the story of the different blues revivals that happened in America, you know, the different sort of ups and downs, and, you know, she crosses paths with so many interesting characters, so many different bands that she plays with, and, you know, guys like Johnny Otis, you know, she plays with for a while, and Muddy Waters, and just all these different characters that she crosses paths with.
Yeah, the impressive point for me was those other blues legends were mostly men, but she, of course, was a woman, and she was able to play in the same league, you know, not just a visible sensation or some kind of sensational, maybe dangerous, strong person who punched somebody or any of those stories. But in the first place, she was a great, really great singer with a great voice, a great player of the harmonica. She played drums too, and just incredible for a woman in those days, you know.
Yeah, and a credit performer. It seems like from the descriptions that in the book, you know, she always put on a great show, and you know, but again, always drunk and drinking and yelling at everybody and not taking any. I mean, it seems like maybe she had some anger in her or some ball of fire. Did you ever get to the bottom, maybe, of why you think that was?
One thing is drinking alcohol was a thing that was very familiar for blues musicians, you know, they mostly did drink, you know. The unusual thing was that she, as a woman, didn't try to fit in any picture that she was asked for, like wearing a gown, or, you know, she just was wearing her man suits and her hat, and not trying to be in a picture that people would think she would need to fit in. She didn't care about that. She was just, I'm doing it my way, and I like to do this and this and this. I like to drink. I like to wear those things. And the reason why she did all this, of course, she had in her younger years starting a very hard time. And I mean, I write this in the book that she was very young when she left home, and the good thing was, of course, that she was starting to be in the music business, right? But if you imagine that she was just 14 years, it's not just fun, you know. It's very hard for a 14-year-old girl to just be alone and just being on stage and trying to make a living. And, of course, she didn't have a lot of money, you know, her whole life. She wasn't rich at all. And so life wasn't really easy for her, and she really had hard times. At one point in her younger life, she had a son, and the kid was taken from her from the authorities. So, I mean, there are reasons that really did hurt her, and it hurt her for her whole life. And that might be part of the reasons why she was starting to drink, but I have a little bit of problem of this trying to make a picture of her sad and tragical person, and, you know, who started to get just being mean. I mostly see her as a great artist who did bring up a great show on stage and who loved what she did her whole life. Nobody else could tell her what to do. And, yeah.
Yeah, there's some very funny stories in the book where people try to tell her what to do, and basically they get a punch in the face, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Her name was Big Mama Thornton. How big exactly was she?
Around two meters or so, you know, very long, you know, very, very large, you know, and big, of course, you know, very big. And, of course, that was getting less than in her later years when she got sick.
There's some pictures of the book in the later years where she's tiny. It's a kind of a shocking look. I mean, the thing is, though, that she did drink so much that she basically drunk herself to death at a relatively young age, right?
Like I said, she was an alcoholic, and her later years, it was like that she started to drink in the morning, you know. She had her special drinks that she said were more healthy. That means alcohol mixed with orange juice or with milk, you know, to make it more healthy looking. But of course, that wasn't healthy at all. And she developed stomach cancer, and the doctor told her, stop drinking or you will die. And then she started to mix her alcohol with milk because she thought that, you know, it's better for her stomach. But we all know that doesn't really help, you know.
It's kind of a sad story. She was only 57 or 58 when she died. It's
Yeah, very, very young. I mean, she could be still alive, you know. I mean, she would be now very, very old.
Well, certainly a very interesting lady, and like I said, a lady I didn't know much about, so it was quite interesting to read the book. Is there a song you think that sums up her life or her work or something that stands out for you, a favorite Big Mama Thornton song?
Oh, yeah. I just love her versions of Summertime, and I especially like a song, and that was, in fact, her own favorite song, and that's this old song, That Lucky Old Sun. And it's just incredible. It's just unbelievable good. With a lot of feeling, a lot of, you know, sense for the tune and the words. And it's just, it shows that she was much more than just a blues shouter like with Hound Dog. There was a lot of feeling in this voice. And so I really love those two songs because they show another side of her ability as a singer. And it's those are my favorite songs.
Yeah, let's hear from Big Mama Thornton. Michael Spork, thank you so much.
Well, thanks a lot, and have a great day.
Up in the morning now, out on my job, work like the devil for my pay, oh Lord, yes I do. That lucky but just roll around heaven all day. I fuss with my man, talk for my kid, sweat until I'm wrinkled and gray. That lucky All my troubles.